Welcome to the 183rd edition of Europe Calling. My name is Maximilian Fries. I'm the manager director of Europe Calling. I want to say hello to our discussant, which I'm going to introduce to you when it starts. A few technical remarks. We're going to speak German and English. I'm already thanking our two interpreters who are with us. Where you see the control panel with a little globe, you can change the languages, listen to German or English, whatever you prefer. And this will be also explained in the chat. On the slide, which I'm trying to put on now, you will see what our program will be for today. Here we can see it. Yes. We will have a short introduction by Eric, who will have a little bit more time at the beginning, because the topic today is what he describes in his book. He is sitting in on Vancouver Island, a very nice place. He's a Canadian, and he's going to explain the basics to us. Then Ulrike Malmendier, a German sage of the economy and working for the University of Berkeley. Then Jan Lopez from Germany and Rasmus Andresen from the European Parliament. And after these speeches, we will have time for discussions. As always, you can post your questions on Europe Calling and rate the questions of others. You will soon see the link to Slido. This is important that you also indicate your name. This is much nicer than if everybody is just anonymous. And then I try to pose the questions which are ranked highest. We will record the meeting and we'll then have it on YouTube and online as a podcast. This is something you should bear in mind when you're asking questions. That's for that. But now we're starting with our issue. Our today's issue is the role of economic fairness when it comes to the defense of democracy against its enemies. In January, at a large webinar, we were talking about the strategies of the so-called new right with Fischer Strober from Austria. And today we would like to understand what makes right-wing populism grow and what we can do against it. And I'm going to start with our first speaker who has written a book on this, Eric Protzer. He is a researcher at the Harvard Growth Lab at the Harvard University in the US. His book has the title Reclaiming Populism: How Economic Fairness Can Win Back Disenchanted Voters. And I was going to translate the book title into German, but the interpreters, I think I'm going to do this. But sitting on Vancouver Island is something I'd also like to work remote from, and he will be our keynote speaker. Eric, you have the floor.
Well, thank you so much for having me here today. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to speak to everybody. Let me just see if I can share my screen properly so I can show you my slides. There we go. Can the other panelists just nod if they can see this? Okay, great, great. So it's visible. And so, the journey my co-author and I have been on with this book has really been a fantastic experience. We started off in around even 2018, 2019, talking together about some of the observations we had about populism. And my co-author and I, we're both Canadians, and naturally we sort of see the world through that lens. And we were comparing a lot of the popular explanations one sees for populism in the news, things like immigration and social media, and how could this be happening in the US? It's all these terrible things. Yeah, but we also felt that, well, Canada, for example, is a place with lots of immigrants and lots of social media, and we seem to be doing okay. We have certain little populist moments, but not an eruption on the same scale that has been happening in other countries. And so we, went on this journey together through the course of COVID mostly. We actually wrote the book together entirely remotely and really drove this hypothesis together that there was something missing that we both experienced personally to an extent in Canada, and that is social mobility and economic fairness, the idea that if you have a fair society, a fair economy, anybody should be able to succeed if they are hardworking and talented, no matter the family they were born into. And that's sort of the main thesis of the book that I'm gonna dive into here and compare against some others. We've made lots of friends all over the place through the course of talking about the book and touring around, and I'm very pleased to be able to talk about it here today with all of you. So without further ado, I'll be presenting on my book. You can see here the title is Reclaiming Populism: How Economic Fairness Can Win Back Disenchanted Voters. If I manage to convince you that the hypothesis is compelling, you can find the book online and in bookstores everywhere. So the typical book on populism cites how worrisome some of its leaders are, such as the cast of characters you see on the right here, how threatening these kinds of people are to democratic institutions. And indeed, we can see there have been instances of democratic erosion around the world, places like the US, places like Hungary, places like Poland. So this is very much a serious threat. But then, what a lot of other books on populism do is they offer some kind of very long-standing political concern to explain voters' motives, like there being too many poisonous ideas in society, which, hardly a novel idea, although currently filtered through the lens of social media, like there being too many foreigners in society, or there being too much income and wealth inequality. And our take is quite different. We think that there is a main problem behind populism that is different, is more complicated, and is not as widely discussed, perhaps because it is a little bit complicated and nuanced. And we think that problem is economic unfairness. And we argue that while populist leaders can certainly threaten democracy, the economic unfairness that drives many voters into their arms is a legitimate concern. And thus, we argue in the book that mainstream politicians have an opportunity to reclaim the populist vote, hence the title of the book, by addressing those grievances through public policy. Now, I'm not going to get into all the technical weeds, but I do want to walk us through the idea of economic unfairness, why we think it's driving populism, what the connection is to populism, and what to do about it in my introduction today. So at a very high level, if we're going to come up with a sort of a miniature definition of how we're thinking about the idea of economic unfairness in our book, Reclaiming Populism, we're understanding it as the sense of being unfairly held back from success because, one, opportunity is not equal, and or two, reward is not according to contribution. And when you have a situation like that, then you can have citizens who either have an unlucky start in life or have been knocked down by an economic shock, and we know there have been plenty of those in recent years. And our position is basically that this system of economic unfairness that can permeate in some places and some countries and some parts of some countries can make it very difficult for those in precarious economic positions to get ahead on their own merits. And that in turn leads to the perception of a rigged system in need of forceful correction. And that's why, in part, you see so much populist language around this idea of a rigged system and the need to overthrow it, to replace it with something entirely new. Now, something I want to be very careful about here is that when I'm talking about fair economic outcomes, I'm understanding that differently from the idea of equal economic outcomes. When I'm talking about fair economic outcomes, I'm meaning that as we understand it, as we define it in the book, fairness entails equal opportunity, but then different and unequal outcomes depending on a citizen's contribution to the economy and to society. Now, you might think, well, okay, why should we take this idea seriously? Is this a serious idea that people talk about? As a motivating quote to indicate, I think we should at least explore this idea. I have a quote here from Angus Deaton, who is a Nobel laureate in economics, where he wrote in a Project Syndicate column that inequality is not the same thing as unfairness, And to my mind, it is the latter that has incited so much political turmoil in the rich world today. Some of the processes that generate inequality are widely seen as fair, but others are deeply and obviously unfair and have become a legitimate source of anger and disaffection. We can also see in some of the micro-level, like psychology literature, that it can be important to differentiate between how people react to fair versus equal outcomes. This is a paper from Nature Human Behavior by the Yale psychologists Starman Cheskin and Bloom, with the title "Why People Prefer Unequal Societies," where they actually argue that the salience of fairness as a determinant of economic outcomes is more important than whether those outcomes are ultimately equal or unequal. And they write that there is no evidence that people are bothered by economic inequality itself. Rather, they are bothered by something that is often confounded with inequality or confused with inequality: economic unfairness. So, to generate a bit of intuition on how to distinguish those things, you can think of, for example, the way that, if you go up to an average person on the street in most modern high-income developed societies, people that you meet generally aren't bothered by the fact that, say, Elton John or David Beckham are rich, or that doctors or engineers are well paid in most parts of society. The general perception is that these people, if anything, are idolized, that they're very talented, they're hardworking, they contribute to society, and that's okay. What tends to really bother people is that if they're in a situation where they keep trying, they are hardworking, maybe they also are talented, and they just can't get ahead. And that anger is doubly severe if you have a situation where they perceive others in society who specifically got ahead, got rich in a way that was unfair. That's a very important qualifier. A really great example of that was political attitudes toward the financial class in the wake of the global financial crisis. There's lots of good research on this showing that it's really not just the magnitude of the loss, it's really not just the inequality that results. It was really the unfair way that, for example, the financial class created this catastrophe for the rest of society, got bailed out, and sort of got off without much of a penalty, all while enriching themselves. So there's a lot of anger about that sort of unfairness that can be generated. When we try to make a connection to that unfairness to the geography of populism, there are a variety of ways that have been pursued around sort of specific examples in the literature. Things like the global financial crisis, things even like the China shock, the loss of jobs in the US and Europe to Chinese import competition. But something that we're taking as another angle, as just a general barometer of economic fairness versus unfairness in society, is social mobility. We think that's a very important variable to pay attention to. And it's basically a measure of the extent to which somebody can get ahead in society, get richer, even if they came from a family that was not rich. So, in a low social mobility society, your income strongly depends on how wealthy your parents were a generation before. And if it's the case that your outcomes in life basically, depend on how rich of a family you were born into and not on your talent, not on your effort, that's a very clear violation of economic fairness, as most people in contemporary high-income societies would understand it. Now, an important note here is that there are some people out there who try to essentially argue that social mobility and income inequality are empirically sort of interchangeable, and that this really comes from the Great Gatsby curve you might have heard of, by the also Canadian researcher Miles Corak, where he finds that between, I think it was 13 high-income countries, there's a correlation between income inequality being high and social mobility being low. Our position is that this correlation has been sort of overinterpreted. There are other instances where the correlation just does not hold. For example, subnationally among different départements in France, And there's also causal evidence on the matter from Raj Chetty that shows that while income inequality influences social mobility, so do at least half a dozen other factors with approximately equal strength. Things like commuting times, even the availability of schools, the degree of racial segregation in an area. So it's not really convincing, we feel, to argue that income inequality and social mobility can just be swapped out with one another. They're different measures, they're conceptually different, they're empirically different. And with that in mind, we move forward with our analysis. And what we show is that low social mobility is a robust statistical predictor of the geography of contemporary rich world populism, both across different countries and also within regions of countries that we're able to get data for. The research behind our book, linking low social mobility to populism, it's been cited by the European Union, the OECD, the UN, the IMF, and others in official publications. And we had a particularly nice endorsement from Professor Philip McCann, who is the man who coined the term geography of discontent. And he cited our research to write that social mobility is the crucial indicator of populist voting. So we were very, pleased to get a ringing endorsement from him. We find that other measures like income and wealth inequality, immigration, and social media penetration do not have the same systematic cross-cutting predictive association with populism, but we acknowledge in the book that the latter cultural factors especially may be accelerating factors, especially when interacted with economic unfairness. And there was a great quote to build some intuition from this from The Economist, where in 2019 they did a survey of East German voters who support Alternative für Deutschland. And what they found was that many surveyed East German voters resented the resources being devoted to help newcomers when they felt left behind. And that's a really important component to that, I think. And they disliked the labeling of their complaints as racist. And it's not hard to imagine how this could work. If you're in a situation of economic unfairness, you can't get ahead. There's a perception that there's all these newcomers arriving, and there's being resources devoted to them instead of to the struggling German, East German communities. Well, I mean, it's not hard to imagine how those things can interact to create more anger. So, if one is, intrigued or takes this hypothesis seriously, that social mobility is something we should pay attention to, economic fairness is something we should pay attention to in order to try to diffuse the threat of populism to the degree that we can, naturally, one next has to ask, how can a policymaker actually pursue a fairer and more socially mobile society? Now, something that I want to get out of the way immediately is that there tend to be very ideological views of this question, and I don't find them very convincing. This is a scatter graph where on the vertical axis, it has countries with low social mobility at the top and countries with high social mobility at the bottom. And then the left-right axis is just government spending as a share of GDP. And we can see very quickly that there are countries that do badly on social mobility that really span the gamut. There are ones that have small government and are famous for doing so, places like the United States and Switzerland. And there are places with very large governments that do so, places like France. So it's not that there are these ideological silver bullets that are just going to easily solve this problem. We think it's a lot trickier to address, and you have to think very carefully about the combination of policy inputs that work together to create social mobility. And in particular, what we do in our book is we try to argue that these types of policy inputs that combine to create social mobility can be categorized under two buckets. And those buckets are equal opportunity and fair unequal outcomes. So let's think that through a little bit. And countries like Australia, Canada, and the Nordic, the Scandinavian countries, those tend to be the ones with the highest social mobility of anywhere in the world. In general, they tend to pair state-sponsored equal opportunity with a commitment to competitive markets. And that allows people to become productive, translate that productivity to real gains. These places enjoy high social mobility, and they haven't experienced major populist institutional disruption. This isn't to say that any place is completely empty of any populism whatsoever. That's an important caveat, but it means that these places, they have lower vote shares. They haven't experienced the same kind of disruption as one has seen from things like Trump and Brexit, for example. I have to acknowledge in particular that there is some degree of support for populism in the Scandinavian countries that is very frequently talked about in the literature. But I think it's also important to note that the vote share for the populist parties in those places is not at the levels of some comparators in Europe. There hasn't been a large institutional disruption in those places. So there's the way we think of it is that there is a firewall against populism where people can't tap into this deep-seated economic anger, and that sort of contains the level of populism to a moderate containable level. Places that fail on either of those categories of inputs, in contrast, suffer the consequences. So, for example, the United States is very famous for its fierce market competition. It certainly has competitive outcomes, but it's also well known for not having a very good social safety net. It does not support equal opportunity in any substantive way. If you come from a low-income family, it can be very hard to get ahead because the government inputs to support that are missing. France, on the other hand, has world-class public services, a world-class social safety net, but it also suffers from low social mobility. And we argue that that is because it regulates and taxes away the fruits of success that ultimately prevent people from succeeding in the marketplace. Both of these countries, very different economic systems, but they both suffer from low social mobility and fierce populist movements because they fail on one of these categories of inputs. To imagine why these two buckets of inputs, equal opportunity and fair unequal outcomes, are so important, you can imagine the life trajectory of someone who experiences social mobility. So, think of somebody who is born into, say, a working class family, and they aspire to become middle class by the time that they're an adult. Now, starting off in life, they need all kinds of things related to inputs that are associated with equal opportunity. You need to be able to become productive. You need to be able to access the job market. You need to have some kind of security in case things are derailed by some kind of an unfair shock. You can think of things like education that allows you to become productive, healthcare so that if you get sick, you aren't bankrupted, transport infrastructure so you can access jobs, you can access education, housing so you can live where opportunities are located. But then at the same time, you also, at that point in your life, need access to competitive markets. Because if you just have those state-sponsored inputs to equal opportunity, you are only productive in theory. You're not productive in practice. And it's that access to markets that is the complement that allows you to translate social mobility to reality. So, you can access this job market, you can get an education, but then you have to be able to get a good job. There have to be jobs available, there have to be competitive businesses available, and that has to take place in a framework of fair competition so that people aren't undergoing, monopolism or polluting excessively, unsafe business practices, all of those things. So if I can, have some final thoughts before turning it over to the discussion, we certainly argue in our book that economic unfairness, we see it as the main grievance behind populism. We observe that politicians often demonize the populist electorate. For example, one can think of Hillary Clinton's infamous basket of deplorables comment. We see that as very counterproductive. We think that instead, that one can have an opportunity to take populist voters' grievances very seriously to address economic unfairness. And by building really credibly a more fair and socially mobile society, there is an opportunity to reclaim the populist vote. At the same time, we have to acknowledge that this is very hard to accomplish. Only a handful of countries and regions thereof have actually accomplished the creation of high social mobility. It's hard to do. So thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to hearing from the other panelists and from the audience. So I'll pass things over.
Vielen Dank, Erik. Bin ich auch schon sehr gespannt. Ich glaube, du hast schon jetzt eine sehr gute Grundlage
Thank
von
you
das.
very much, Eric. I'm also very interested in what people are going to say. Now we are going to talk with Professor Lynn Malmedy, who's a professor at the University of Berkeley in the US, and she's a member of the expert panel for analyzing the macroeconomic development in Germany, one of the sages of the economy, as they are called. Ulrike is a behavioral economist, is also looking at the human behavior in economic situations. And all these are very, very interesting topics. And I'm really keen on hearing what you have to say. I'm very happy that you found the time today, Ulrike, and we're looking forward to what you have to tell us.
Well, thank you. And of course, thank you for the invitation. I've actually been part of the Economic Council for the government since 2022. But the question is, how long can I keep going across the Atlantic? But well, a podcast like this, that's easy enough to do. So this hypothesis in Eric's book is really interesting, I think. And of course, that makes me think like a behavioral economist, because economists are often said to just think about what people wanting to maximize their profit, their payoff. But we're improving that. They're actually trying to maximize their welfare. But even there, we would, as behavioral economists, would like to go further. So a very important element, we're saying, of a very important part of what's important to us as people in our behavior, etc., and what we're trying to achieve, is driven by social preferences, in fact. And these are preferences that apply to not just how I'm doing, but also how others are doing and how I am doing in relation to others. And so that relates to the concept of fairness, like in Eric's book. So it is very important. But there are other concepts like equity preferences, equality preferences. They are also important, so that inequality can't be too large in a society, and then reciprocity can be positive, can be negative. So sometimes I am willing to have less if somebody else then will be doing better, and sometimes not. So these are very important concepts that we should, which we should take a lot more seriously in economics, not just in our theoretical models and studies, but also in the real world. So I think it's great that this concept, at least of economic fairness, is being pushed like this. And I also believe it's great because it makes me hopeful. Because it just creates hope for those countries where we have this increase of populism, the populist wave, how we can counter that. So if you're only thinking along the lines that this rise of populism is due to large parts of the population not doing so well, you're instantly caught in that right-wing, left-wing spectrum. So you want more government spending, you would like less support for certain parts of the population, but don't forget entrepreneurs, they're the ones creating jobs. So that will immediately put you in that field of tension between right and the left. But if we're saying, no, it's not about more or less spending, and it's not about one-sided benefits or support for certain parts of the population, but it is, like Eric stated very clearly, it's about equal opportunities for everyone, and also about your contribution being rewarded fairly. And that is a concept that many people could subscribe to. So also, let's say the more conservative side of democratic parties, that is more about a merit-based society. So that kind of makes me hopeful that using this type of axis or analysis to social justice or injustice, maybe will bring us to progress in the fight against right-wing populism. But so We do want a discussion, so I'm going to put forward some other arguments. So just to be clear, I'm sure that in Eric's book this has been stated clearly as well. So if we accept a large gap between different parts of the population, that we should just ignore that because it's the result of equal opportunities. So if you have a major shock, then economic shock, then voters could also tend to protest parties. Let's say in Germany we had the National Socialists. That was also partly after economic crisis and after the First World War. So it's a good example for that. I'm not saying that social mobility didn't also play a part. I'm just saying we can't forget about these concepts. So when a large part of the population isn't doing so well, that can also lead to protest votes, to populism, and easy access to populist slogans. So I want to criticize this, but I think it's too narrow to just look at fairness. And then another aspect, just with regard of the current situation, insecurity. So we're living in a world that changes really fast. The workplace, employees have been living that for decades. Even in countries like Germany, where the digital transition is really slow, we still have had changes. We've got different devices, have to use different data now, digital data. And if we're sticking with Germany, we have an aging population and a shrinking labor force. So we do need more migration, and that's another change, another type of change. And for many people, that then looks like a totally different world as compared to the world they grew up in. And you can't just tell them, well, just deal with it. We need it in order to keep our welfare. That would be too easy. Because that type of insecurity, I think, also leads people to then look at those simple solutions, populist votes and protest votes, etc. And in order to counter that, you'd need different solutions. So let's say I work in an industry with a lot of structural change, and the world is changing very fast. And you have to take these people seriously, and also give them the impression that they have control, so that they're not left alone and that they're not left powerless. So these aspects can be measured: controllability, predictability. But they can be measured economically, but they're often ignored anyways in economists' models. So that should be taken into account no matter what the economic results. And then one last aspect, and that's related to my own research, no surprise. And I've been working on experience effects. And that is the concept, experience effects, that the experience that we're making across our life, so in our case, financial crisis, COVID, then there was the economic crisis, 2007, 8, etc. You can look further back, the Great Depression, etc. So these major experiences will become part of people. So suddenly, things were very insecure, the economy broke down, or the stock exchange, inflation exploded. So when that shock was large enough or long enough, it really turns into something that people won't forget. And it may lead to them looking at their reality through a different lens. And you can't just wave that aside, and you can't just say, well, we can now, after the financial crisis, make sure that things are fairer and then it's okay, because you'll still going to have a consumer slightly more insecure, more critical, a little bit nervous. And that's not going to change even if the economy comes down again. So that's a kind of reality check. So this type of change in attitudes in parts of the population that has come about because, yes, lack of fairness and negative economic developments isn't so easy to counteract, to turn them away from populist parties. Even if we implemented Eric's book from overnight and every country would just focus on fairness, I'm afraid that the effects would maybe be slower to realize than we might hope, or we might hope after listening to Eric's great presentation. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I think that's going to be a great discussion. I have lots of questions, and we also have lots of questions in Slido. I'm posting the link again, so you can rank other people's questions and post your own for a discussion later on. So I'm going to continue now with Jean Lopez. He's a climate activist and publicist of a magazine and also the informal counselor of the SUMA, the Progressive Electoral Coalition in Spain. And we have worked together with SUMA before. And Jean just joined us last Friday because originally there was another speaker from Spain, Sara, but she had to cancel. So I'm really grateful that Jean agreed to join us at such short notice. And I'm really looking forward to him telling us about this topic, please.
Hi, so thank you for the invitation. I will see if I can share my screen because I have some slides. I think you should be able to see this. And like that. So can you see the slides or someone can,
yeah.
Thank you. So I will try to be brief. I think what they, what you asked me to present was like a case study of how a country managed to beat a right-wing populism wave. This happened last summer in Spain, where it seemingly, you know, a coalition of the right-wing traditional party and the right-wing populist or far-right party, everybody was expecting them to win, and in the end, they didn't. So I will have some thoughts on how this happened. I'm going to use for this explanation a framework from Machiavelli, which is very famous. He says that, you know, political outcomes are usually determined by a combination of what he calls fortuna and virtù, which is things that we do not control as human beings and things we do. And yeah, there's a lot to this, and they combine in several ways. But I think the main idea here is that both these factors, in my opinion, were instrumental in defeating the right-wing wave in Spain in 2023. Perhaps the things we do not control, like the fortuna ones, were more important in the end. I will talk about this later, but I think both were important. And in any case, like Machiavelli himself says, I think if you are good at what you can control, that allows you to seize opportunities when they arise. So both factors are important. So I will present two factors of each one, of each type. The first one is the general economic and social policy of the coalition government. This ties very neatly with Eric's presentation. I didn't actually know what he was going to talk about, so I think that's a good coincidence. Basically, the summary here is that the coalition government implemented a very large number of socioeconomic reforms in the country. There's way too many to list them, but some of the key ones I would say were a fairly dramatic rise of the minimum wage. It went up by almost 50% in only 5 years. It was by far the, you know, fastest increase in the minimum wage in history in Spain. They implemented a wide spectrum of inflation fighting measures. Perhaps it's well known that both Spain and Portugal managed to achieve some sort of exception from the usual market rules for the electricity markets, and this was important to reduce the bills for a lot of people. They implemented cheap or also free public transit in some places. They implemented windfall profit tax for banks and electricity utility companies. They also implemented new social programs like ERTEs, which were like a pandemic program to help companies to not fire people. I think this happened all over Europe and was concentrated in Europe. They implemented something they call IMV, which is a sort of basic income program that was not, I would say, particularly well implemented, but it was a step forward for some people that helped them also through the pandemic and the following crisis. So like I say, there's many such programs. All of them together, I think, were perceived as an actual change in how things have been done in Spain for the last, you know, 10 years before that, for sure, with the right-wing government since the financial crisis. But, and this is where it ties with Eric's comments, I think this did not win over new voters, perhaps because they were mostly fighting inequality and not so much like changing structural factors that make the Spanish economy unfair. That being said, I think they maintained the existing one, so they prevented some people from fleeing the coalition government. And also, and this is perhaps more important, they prevented an entire type of attack on the government during the election by the right-wing parties. Basically, they couldn't really attack the government on what they had done with the economy because they implemented ambitious social programs, and also the economy as a whole was doing better than ever, and also even better than most European countries on average. So I think this was a key factor in allowing the re-election of the coalition government. The other factor that, you know, was under our control was Sumar itself, I would say. Sumar managed to reconstruct most of the broken left-wing alliance that Podemos had created in record time, and it's been the largest or the widest electoral coalition in Spanish history. And this was important because it made it a viable electoral coalition because of how elections work and the, you know, election rules that we have. If many small left-wing parties competing are not viable, and you're just basically throwing away votes. I'm sure this is the same in many other countries. So the fact that Sumar existed and managed to form this coalition was important in maintaining you know, a viable coalition arithmetic for the final election. And also perhaps a bit secondary, but I think Sumar in general sense a shift in Spanish politics from a hot populist, like progressive populist era with Podemos to a colder one where people were not so receptive anymore to some types of messaging or policies or, you know, or attacks on other parties and so on. So I think those two things together managed to allow Sumar to escape irrelevance, like it has happened to other progressive populist parties in Europe in the last years. But it also created a risk of, you know, subordination to PSOE, which is the senior you know, partner in the coalition. This has been exacerbated by Pedro Sánchez, the president's personal qualities and his ability to steer PSOE away from some, you know, historical pitfalls that PSOE falls in time and time again. But in any case, this, you know, these dynamics between a senior social democratic party and a junior leftist party are long-term, at least in Spanish politics, and they always are always there, and they are not something new. But I think this time we have managed to escape them better than other times. So that's it for like the things we control. Now the things we do not control, actually, but that were very important in this election. The first one is just how Spanish politics are structured, and I only have 5 minutes or so, so obviously I cannot like explain here properly what happened. But basically, for both long-term, very long-term historical reasons, like the lack of a unifying national, you know, popular revolution that created a unified national country, like maybe happened in France or Germany or other places, and also because of short-term policy choices by the right-wing parties in the last decade or so. The right-wing parties have performed terribly, and I mean absolutely terribly, in both Catalonia and Euskadi. in this map, those are like the northeast corner of the country and the north, center north parts of the country. You can identify them because there's no blue in them. Blue is the right wing color in the election. Historically, it's extremely challenging to win a national, like a statewide election without those votes. What's a bit astonishing here is that they came really close to making it. People always assumed it was basically impossible, but they came pretty close, but in the end, they couldn't pull it off. Of course, it's not easy to change the structural factors here. So right-wing, like Spanish right-wing parties have always done poorly in those regions, but in the past, they didn't do so terribly like now. And in that, so the conclusion here is that in the last years, only the center-left bloc has managed to assemble viable governing coalitions for the country. So, you know, either the right wing will have to change a bit their policies here, or maybe this will keep happening, or maybe, you know, there will be an even bigger surge of right wing populism and will pull it off in the end. I don't know, but that's what has happened so far. And the other thing we do not control, which is maybe the most amusing one, is that I would say the right wing, especially the traditional right wing party, the PP, is not really doing great. It's not ruled by particularly smart people or, you know, people able to adapt to events and things like that. So they executed one of the most disastrous campaigns in recent memory. As far as, you know, having an adult, I don't remember such a disastrous campaign, especially the last week and a half. Was a total nightmare for them with, you know, one after another truly horrendous events on TV and declarations to the press and things like that. So it was really a nightmare. And in Spain, you cannot publish polls in that week, but there were like leaks saying that their support was collapsing and so on. And the second thing is that the far-right party, Vox, has stoked fears of specific political regressions in Spain, related to linguistic or, you know, nationalist rights that exist now in the country, LGBTI, cultural and institutional regressions. Both PP and Vox said they would form a government together. So everybody knew these threats were real and they would probably happen or they will try to implement them. And here I think the key thing is that people in general are not afraid of fascism like as an abstract thing, but they are really afraid of tangible specific threats to their freedoms that politicians make. So the result of this is that the center-left plus nationalist voters in Spain went out to vote in very large numbers again, like has happened in the past few elections. And the end result was that they got more than 1 million more votes than the right-wing bloc, and that's why they are in government again. So that's it. I tried to be really quick. The summary would be that the center-left coalition implemented necessary social economic reforms and constructed a sort of virtuous relationship between its parties. They were not super ambitious reforms, so they did not address structural reforms that are necessary, but you know they were much better than most people were expecting, probably. The right-wing coalition ignored some structural national limits in Spanish politics and also executed a disastrous campaign. And like I said, here maybe the elements we do not control were probably more decisive, but without the first ones, the virtuous ones, it will have been impossible to seize the opportunity and keep the central government. And that's it. So thank you very much.
Ja, ich danke auch. Ganz herzlichen Dank. Ich glaube, darüber könnte man auch noch allein über das spanisch-politische System und die
Thank you very much. I think we could have a seminar on Spanish history and Spanish politics. And now I'm leading over to our last invitee, Rasmus Horesen, Speaker of the Greens in the European Parliament. He is in the Committee for Economics and Monetary Affairs. He advocates for more justice in tax questions also. He was quite successful, I believe, with the authority against tax fraud in the European Union, also an interesting topic for tonight. Rasmus, please.
Thank you. And I'd also like to thank the other speakers for very interesting inputs and insights and thoughts that we really should discuss more often. Maybe two things first that I'm taking away from the statements we've heard now. So one, economic inequality, social inequality, and social mobility. That those should be at the center, or more at the center of the political debate. And then two, after the Spanish example, that right-wing pressure that we have in some European countries and in the US isn't just a sort of a natural catastrophe that we can't avoid, but it can be avoided with the right policies. And with the right policies, it's in our hands to stop this development that many in the European Union are afraid of now, that we're going to wake up to a European Parliament after the 9th of June with a center-right majority. So it can still be avoided with the right political answers and societal commitment and work over the next few weeks. So maybe we should look to Spain for these examples rather than trying to pander to right-wing parties and trying to win their voters that way. So I think we have different approaches that we should discuss here. So social mobility in our societies, from a German point of view, yet that is a major topic, or should be a major topic. The federal government, Germany, we are one of the countries with the lowest social mobility. I'm going to refer to both two of the other speakers as sort of largely US American, so they'll understand that. But we have a lot of inheriting wealth in Germany, and so that's one of the reasons, among others, and also the education system, why social mobility is low in Germany, and why we also have so many people turning away and being disenchanted with democracy. So I can agree with you there. But I also believe that insecurity, instability, economical insecurity in these times after having lived through the pandemic is another major factor. Then also the terrible war of aggression, Putin's war in Ukraine. And then, of course, economic insecurity, high inflation, and the majority of people in Germany and in other European countries have income losses in real terms. So that is another factor. Social mobility is something to be afraid of for many people right now, because they're afraid that they could go down the ladder rather than up. So I think these two elements have to be connected as well. And then my third point. So apart from these questions, looking to the future, so insecurity for the next years, lack of mobility, lack of perspectives for rising on climbing the social ladder, or being afraid of losing out. That's one thing, but there are also things that are very concrete now, so effects that are being felt as we speak. So they're not just anxieties. Many people in the European Union are now actually getting hit with their incomes, because the costs, living costs, are rising faster than real wages. And that was different at the beginning of this legislative period in 2019. We have more than 100 million people in Europe below the poverty line. And personally, I believe it's very important that a side of mobility and insecurity, we really look at the actual material status of people after the many years of crisis. So they're not, people are not just thinking about the future and being afraid of the future, but they are already suffering very concrete consequences. And even though we have had some policies at the European level and at the national level, in many member states, too little has been done to help people to regain their social security. So I think these are the three elements: social mobility, insecurity with a view to the future, and income losses now. And that's what we need to take into account to find solutions and responses and political perspectives to improve our political perspectives here in the EU, but also in the US. I don't want to talk about that now too long. That's maybe for the discussion. But I believe that any answers will also be found at the EU and the national level. What should our budgetary policy look like? Should we try to decrease debts, or do we need more public investment? We've got the discussion about minimum wages and a discussion about fiscal policy, and maybe we should tax profits by larger companies that have been doing well over the past years, more than we have been doing, and then also the wealth tax, etc. That all could contribute to more social mobility and social security in order to finance that. And I think that really has to be discussed more offensively over the next weeks and months. And on the European level, after the 9th of June, we'll have to find the political majorities for that, because otherwise we won't be able to turn this around. Thank you. So now we have 30 minutes for a discussion. And I would like to go back to Eric now, maybe to respond, because Ulrike, for once, had a couple of remarks to you, two remarks, so inequality, but then also insecurity. So I would like to hear your reaction to that. And the other speakers also mentioned it. And then my question to everyone, but to Eric as well, what do you think about Jean's contribution, what Spain did? Is that something that you looked at when you researched for your book? Or does that kind of cover your proposals? Did they do it right, according to you?
Thank you so much. I want to thank the other panelists for their very thoughtful, insightful presentations and questions. What a wonderful discussion. A couple of points were raised about thinking of justice in a multifaceted term, and I could even see there were some questions in the chat about, you know, John Rawls' works and whatnot. I think that all of these are basically you know good points that we need to think about more seriously, you know, both in popular discussion but also in academia. You know, you mentioned Ulrike that the economic profession tends to focus heavily on things like profit maximization, you know, GDP growth and all that. And that's absolutely true, I think. And I think we would benefit from a more detailed analysis, measurement, discussion of what does economic justice actually mean? And to the points of Rasmus and others around, you know, the importance of absolute deprivation. That is also important. That is linked to you know, GDP growth. To be fair, it's an important thing, and you can't have people just living in absolute poverty. Of course, you're going to get very angry if you have that kind of situation. And there are these other facets of justice one wants to consider, you know, equity and reciprocity and what have you. And what we've found is that in the context of these high-income democracies, that this measure of social mobility tends to be very salient. There's other complementary literature that shows that if a shock is especially unfair, it's the unfairness of that shock that really makes that really makes people angry, even more than the magnitude of the shock. There was a really interesting study I liked that I think speaks to this question, where they looked at different macroeconomic crises in industrialized countries from the 1800s to present. And what they found was that there were essentially two categories they looked at: financial macroeconomic crises and excusable macroeconomic crises, things like natural disasters, something like that, where there's just a shock and there's nobody to blame in society for a loss of income. And what they found was that there was much more political anger, much more support for far right parties generated when it was a financial crisis specifically, even for the same amount of loss of income, the same amount of loss of welfare. So I just think, I think it's very important to think about all these different measures of economic justice in a more complex way than we do. I do think fairness is a really important one, but, we should absolutely talk about other ones as well. And hopefully that's a direction for future research.
Vielen Dank. Jetzt für die weiteren Fragen würde ich
Thank
das
you very much for the further questions. I'm going to post three questions from our Slido page and put them to the four panelists. You can raise your hand, use the hand raising icon if you want to contribute. If you don't want to speak to a certain question, that's all right too, but just raise your hand and then you can say something answering the question. Now, Christiane Bodensee. Christiane asks, do you have an idea why the traffic light government who introduced more social security is hated by the population? Those who have received the citizens' money would vote for other parties. So the government is not really profiting from that. That's a question from Christiane Hohensen, which I will connect to an English question, Adam. And I'm translating this into German now. If unfairness fosters populism, why then is it so that the major part of those voters vote for right-wing populists, which don't want to do anything great for more fairness? Why don't they vote for left-wing populists? Why have we such a push to the right? That's what Adam asks. And then there is Irene Müller, which also poses a very interesting, important question. It says, what's the influence of unpaid care work on economic unfairness? So those were the questions. Who would like to start? Just raise your hand. Ulrike Malmedy, please. Yes, with pleasure. As to the first and the second question, I think I can answer those a little. Why do people hate the traffic light government, despite the fact that we have supported social protection? Well, I'd say, first of all, this could be an interesting topic for Eric. Eric, I think, would say, well, as to the citizen support we have introduced, people might say that what is rewarded is not performance or contribution or effort. People receive money without really having earned it, some people would say, I think. But there are other aspects. But there are aspects when that is true. When we said in the expert panel that there could be more justice, but that was also misused politically. This would be one thing. But then I would also say A lot of things happened in the course of the last years. We had just left Corona when there was the energy crisis because of Putin's aggression towards Ukraine. Prices went through the roof and many things changed. People had to wonder how they could pay their bills. And unfortunately, politicians are then sanctioned for this. Eric said it depends whether the change is something we are responsible for or not. And this is true. But when our gas prices rose because Putin invaded Ukraine, this is one thing. But then there are other outcomes for which the politicians are punished. And then many aspects change in our life currently. If we want to do something against climate change, if we want the green transition, things have to change, which force people to change their lives. And sometimes people don't like this. And then our energy law, our heat pumps we want to install. I have installed one, but it's also something which costs something. It's difficult to oblige people to do that. And in this respect, I think we need more controllability and predictability. This is very important, especially when it comes to such political questions. And then I'd also like to say something as to the second question. I'd love to know the ultimate answer to this. In the United States, it's even worse. There is no social system, and that there are people who have a very difficult life and don't manage to advance socially, that they have political attitudes which are really right-wing or in favor of Trump. Well, this is something which I don't understand completely, but there are certain aspects which I do understand. I'm an economist, is something which has often to do with certain ideas about who your enemies are, that the people who come from Mexico, for example, or from other regions in South America, that those are the people who are a threat for me, that those are the people who are responsible for my bad situation. And this abuse is also helpful for people at the right political spectrum. How this works, I don't understand, and I hope that some people maybe can explain me that. Well, maybe Rasmus can do that. I don't know whether I can do this, but I try to answer the first question. I think it's a mixture of real circumstances, which, as has been described, do exist for many people. Despite the social reforms, people's lives have often not improved in the last couple of years. And those necessary reforms, which we like to implement, sometimes they would not have been so difficult for the people concerned, even if it needs a certain system change. And also future governments, I think, would have to think about that and go that way. Additionally, I believe, and this is another problem, irrespective of the topic we're talking about, but it's particularly true when it comes to the economy, I think people are not of one opinion of how problems can be solved. And that's maybe a little bit different than the situation in Spain. Because they had a clear political agenda and were then successful. But what we did was interpreted in different ways. And what the effect is of what we have decided has been discussed a lot. This is a discussion which takes place at many levels at the moment. There is a lot of criticism, and that's particularly true when it comes to economic and social questions. And it's very different if your name is Robert Habeck or Christian Lindner. This is an additional explanation to what has already been said about this topic. I believe that this is a reason for the fact that right-wing populism is often very successful, because they are the first who, but they and they get the votes of those who would suffer very much if right-wing populists were in government. But this is about this sense of insecurity, and this is something that can be abused by right-wing parties reactions as to migration attitudes which have changed as to migration policy can only explain like that. And therefore, it's good that currently we see in Spain that this is not a natural law, a law of nature. And Spain is a good example, but there are other European countries like Austria. There are regional examples, especially in Salzburg, of that fact. And I do believe that also in the USA, where we don't know what is going to happen this year, but where we also realized that left-wing movements, Bernie Sanders with a progressive agenda, compared to his European counterparts, Joe Biden has also said progressive things, and they can help to vanquish right-wing parties. There is a possibility that Donald Trump is re-elected, but there is also the possibility that Joe Biden will remain in power with a different agenda. And if he did not have a social agenda, I think his chances would be much worse. And that's why I'm still hopeful that with a different political agenda, you can stop those developments.
Eric?
Thank you, Eric, please.
Thank you. First of all, I realized I forgot to answer the question about Sean's presentation, which I thought was very interesting and useful. I think that was a good example of sort of how to get through an immediate threat. And I liked the combination of vertu and fortune, to be able to get through these things. I think nevertheless that Spain has some structural reform to go through if it wants to get on a path where it really is durably more socially mobile, more resistant. I mean, we could spend another whole couple of hours talking about that. I also want to address in particular the second question about why is it that populism tends to be right wing? And first of all, I would note that there is some left wing populism. Syriza, the Greek left wing populist party, is a good example. But I agree with the thrust of the question that it tends to be that most populists are right wing, and why is that? And I think there are two reasons essentially. One, I think, is to do with the nature of unfairness and the perception of unfairness. If you're in a situation where you're really struggling with social mobility, you're really struggling with a perception of a society and an economy that is not treating you fairly, then that is tightly linked to your perception of cooperation with the rest of society. From your point of view, if society is working against you, why would you cooperate with the rest of society and pursue left-wing political ideas that are based on the idea of society-wide cooperation? I think it's much more natural for somebody in that situation of experiencing unfairness to instead turn toward their closer tribal members. You look for people in your in-group who you can really trust for protection and cooperation because you don't trust the rest of society for protection and cooperation. And that, I think, is one important reason why it tends to skew toward this right-wing identitarian politics that is about protecting a specific in-group as opposed to the left-wing universalist solutions. I think another element has to do with political and economic geography. The reality is that many of the economic shocks that have transpired in countries with low social mobility have specifically transpired in geographies that were already relatively conservative. You can see that, for example, in the geography of the China shock, the losses from jobs associated with import competition from China that hit the Rust Belt in the U.S. Those sort of southern rural areas that are famously very conservative, often very evangelical Christian, that hit them really, really hard. And that is tightly related to the lack of social mobility as well, and the vote swing toward Trump. So I think it's those two things. I think that there was a pre-existing tendency for these kinds of voters to identify with conservative politics to begin with in many cases. And then in addition, that the nature of the challenge, the nature of economic unfairness, further pushes them toward that that right wing politics.
Danke dir, Jeanne. Als nächstes, und Jeanne, ich möchte
Thank
noch
you. Jeanne is next, but just one more question to add from Zara on Slido, and she's asking, taking a look at Portugal. And the Iberian half peninsula, it was completely different there. Right wing parties have really had a great victory. So maybe you could add to that what you think about that in comparison to Spain. Interesting question from Sarah. Please, Stan.
Yeah, thank you. So I'm going to do something I shouldn't do, but someone was asking why, you know, the German government is not being able to do something similar to the Spanish government, like capitalizing the social initiatives it's been doing. I'm saying this as an observer, obviously, from the outside. I'm not an expert in German politics, but I see that maybe there's two things that seem to me different that could explain to some extent that situation. And it's like a unity of message and action and a bit of decisiveness in how they implement policies, these policies. So the unity, I think this has been mentioned already, the German government is a coalition of three parties, very different, and they have very different opinions on some key issues. And this reflects on how they present themselves in public and the, you know, struggles they have to agree on what to do. In the case of the coalition government in Spain, there were only two major parties in the government itself, although the parliament coalition is much larger. And I think one key factor here is that they had a unified message on at least economic policy and most of the social policy. There were infamous disagreements on some feminist topics, but for the most part they had a unified message on these issues, and they were not fighting among themselves about how to about what to do. And I think there's one anecdote that is perhaps illuminating about this. I think it was in 2022, one member of the parliament from the far right party was asking the government, was saying that he didn't know a single Spaniard that benefited from what the coalition government was doing. And the finance minister, Nadia Calviño, who is now at the European Investment Bank, and who was famously on the right wing of the Social Democratic Party, so, you know, on the very right wing of the party, like a neoliberal hawk on many issues. She gave a very famous speech saying, so you don't know a single Spaniard who is on minimum wage, you don't know a single Spaniard who is benefiting from free transit, you don't know a single Spaniard who is benefiting from the investment on, you know, industry and businesses and so on. And she spoke like for a minute saying, you know, like 20 measures like this, and she got like huge standing ovation, and, you know, this was a very widely shared video. And I think that for me, the takeaway here is that this message went from the very left wing of the government to the most right wing elements of the Social Democratic Party, and they all agreed that what they were doing was the right thing to do, and what, you know, was getting through and was okay. So I think this was an important thing to send a message to the voters, like, you know, we all agree on these policies and we are all on board on them. And then the second thing here is that I think historically, at least in Spain, the left is very timid in implementing their policy choices. So they always do like these pilot programs, and they test things for a bit, and they see what happens, and they're very afraid of what people are going to say and so on. And in the end, they barely do anything, and then the right wing wins, and they do like, you know, half a dozen structural major reforms in like 2 months, and then we all suffer from it for years. So I think, again, in Spain, what happened was that they implemented some pretty big changes fairly quickly, and there was a dynamic, like people would say, this is impossible to do, or if you do it, it will be a disaster. And, you know, traditionally, this might have been a huge debate, but they just went ahead and did it. Like, they raised, like I said, the minimum wage a lot. They said we were going to be able to get like the next generation agreement in Europe, or we were going to be able to get Europe to agree on this reform of the, you know, electricity market. And people said, this is impossible. You will never get Europe to agree to it. And then it happened and they implemented it and, you know, everything was okay. And there's many examples like this. So I think there was an element of decisiveness, or just going ahead with what you think it's necessary at the moment, without getting lost in, you know, like in endless debates and back and forth and pilot programs that people really don't understand or appreciate. So I would say those are maybe two important for me, you know, elements. About Portugal, I think perhaps one very fundamental issue that I covered is that my understanding is that they did not manage to assemble this viable electoral coalition. So if you see the result of the last election, there were like at least four or five small left-wing parties, green parties that got like 2%, 3% of the vote. So this is exactly what Sumar managed to avoid in the last general election. They assembled a very large coalition that, you know, put together all those votes and managed to retain most of the, you know, left-wing votes that Podemos had in the past. And I think this was instrumental to allowing the central government to be maintained. Without that, it would have been lost for sure, because the difference in, you know, in members of the parliament between the right-wing bloc and the center-left bloc was minimal. So this was extremely important. And just to finish, I had one question actually. So sorry if I use my turn to ask one more question, but at least in Spain, historically, the voters for this far right, right-wing populist party Vox have been not the ones suffering from, you know, the unfairness of the economic system, but have been traditionally better off than average. So they were not rich by any means, but they were like middle class, even, you know, high income in some cases. This has changed a bit in the last election. So now they are a bit more transversal to society, but for many electoral cycles, they were definitely better off than, you know, the average person in Spain. And all the other parties had way more voters on, you know, from the working class and so on. So I'm wondering, is this something unique to Spain? I think it's not. And if it's not, what do you think they are reacting to? So I tend to agree that they see something unfair happening, but surely cannot be like, you know, an economic unfairness, because they are still doing better than most people in society. So I wonder how this plays with your theory about, you know, unfairness breeding populism and so on.
Thanks. Dankeschön. Bevor ich Erik dran nehme.
Thank you. Before I give Erik the floor, we don't have a lot of time, so I'm just going to ask another two questions. Then Erik can answer Jean's question, and then Ulrike and Jan get a question. I mean, we could go on forever, I think. But Klaus von Bahnen has a question that I would like to read about the German tax system that's very unfair. He says, as a poor person, I have to pay 25% capital tax, and that's the same as a rich person will pay. So that is a question to Rasmus and Ulrike on the German tax system. And another question also to these two, the capital gains tax, that was. And now Milan Teichmann asks, Eric says that an effective public infrastructure was one important factor. Do you think that the debt break in the US and Germany would have to be abolished in order to finance this? So Eric in answer to Jean, and then the other two on the other questions. Eric, please.
Yeah, thank you. Regarding social mobility in Spain and whether these voters are truly suffering. I mean, obviously I cannot be an expert on the Spanish context like you are, Sean. I'm sure you know much more about you know what's happening within Spain than I do. But what I can say is that in the countries we've studied, whether it's cross country or within a country, it's really consistent that the geography of populism matches up with the geography of low social mobility. I think that one possible way this may play out in Spain is that people sometimes don't only vote based on themselves. They also vote on how they perceive what is happening to society and their community and the people they care about. So it may be the case. I would love to do a study on Spain if subnational social mobility data was available. It could be interesting to see if these kinds of individuals you're mentioning are chances in their own success, but maybe that of their relatives, that of their neighbors. There's certainly anecdotal evidence for that in other areas of the world. Regarding the debt break and public spending, I certainly think that the U.S. is on the side of having to raise expenditure. Yeah, I'll be very brief. I think there has to be a public discussion about the German debt brake too, but again, I will defer to the Germans, who are undoubtedly more experts than I.
Okay, so Rasmus first, and then Ulrike for the last word, and that's of course as it should be as a researcher. I can live with that as a politician, Rasmus said. So tax system, yes, it's a major challenge. And of course, it is very difficult to understand why the German tax system is so unjust. I think we could have a webinar for several hours just on that topic. So I'm going to be just brief on that. So also with a view to social mobility and high wealth, high inheritance, we have a major challenge there, and we do really need a tax reform. And I think I mentioned it during my first statement, and I'd like to repeat it. Another debate will be corporate taxation at the level of the OECD. There's at least a proposal for major multinationals, and all the EU member states have ratified it, but it's not clear what the US will do, even though it was Joe Biden who initiated this process, among others. And Gabriel Zucman, another economist, has proposed at least to have a tax rate for wealth tax. That's an interesting idea, and I would support that, but I would be satisfied if we could just make progress in Germany. And then a public investment and public spending. That has a lot to do with social mobility and inequality, because when public investment isn't there, of course it's going to hit those who are already poor or have a low income. We have 600 billion tax money for green transformation in the EU. And so if that doesn't happen, then who's going to pay if the EU and the member states don't manage to make these investments as promised? And in order to make these investments, actually, we need the political majorities, and we need some reforms also in order to be able to do that spending, to make that spending. That is reforms for the tax system, but also the Stability and Growth Pact at the European level. We have a vote on that in the near future, but it's not going to change anything. The the Stability Growth Pact debt brake will not be changed. It will probably get worse for many member states, and that is a major problem and one of the most urgent topics that we will have in the new legislative period for the European Parliament. Thank you. Rasmus, Ulrike, please. So I have minus 60 seconds now. I'll be brief. Taxes. Well, there are many problems, issues with our tax system. Even if it had been perfect at the outset, you always have different simulations and financial market developments and so on. So it would have to be adapted dynamically all the time. So I'm just trying to say it's really complex, and there's a compromise, a trade-off between not having a too complex tax system, but being fair enough. On the other hand, that is not easy. And then, on the other hand, the argument from the other side is also important. So if it's always the entrepreneurs having to get growth back to Germany in order to pay for the green and digital transformation, then, of course, we want incentives for that as companies. So if we don't have incentives and we have to pay for everything, you're just going to try to get rid of companies. So it's not so easy to solve these problems. But I am really surprised that not more people are upset about this, like this question. I mean, in the US, for instance, Trump can just give more tax breaks to companies, and it's not clear that that had a positive effect on the economy. Maybe it had a short-term effect, and he'll just do that, and he'll still be re-elected. And I mean, I think we need more such critical questions like that question we just had now in order to change things. And then debt break and spending. Well, again, let's look at the other side of that argument. So there are 1,000 opportunities to spend money in a good way for the population. But at some point, that will be to the detriment of politicians and future generations. And so that's why we don't think the debt brake is terrible, but you could be more intelligent about the way you do it. It could be anti-cyclical, for instance. We've talked about that in our expert council. But the main question for me is the prioritization. I mean, debt brake, yes or no, but how can we, for the German budget, really think about what is really a priority for the country in the long term? How can we make sure that we think about future generations, if that's investment in education or the trains, infrastructure? I mean, I don't think that that's a debt brake mechanism. In the past, we've always been below the Stability and Growth Pact. We've just kind of reallocated. I think that is a basic problem, not just in Germany. And I would really like to get examples from other countries where they make the right priorities and focus on the right priorities, really to focus on the future and younger generations and the next decades. And I think that's really our major task. Thank you. Well, this will not be the last webinar on this topic, that's clear. And we've over 5 minutes over time. So I'm just going to close this now. I'd like to thank our guests, and I'd like to thank everyone who's in the audience, who has asked questions. Over the course of the evening, we've had over 1,000 in the audience, and we will have this as a podcast in the future. And Max also thanks the interpreters. And he's listened to half of it. And I would like to thank Andrea, who will pick the best video stretches of this podcast. And I would like to thank everyone who supports us, 3,700 members. And I would like to also talk about our next two webinars on Thursday next week. That's Green Thursday in Germany before Easter. It'll be about refugees and responsibility. And on the 11th of April, we will have a discussion with Robert Habeck, our Vice Chancellor, about the transformation in Europe. And we've had, now we've collected a number of questions that maybe Robert Habeck can answer then. So you'll get your invitation for that. I would like to thank everyone and wish you a very pleasant evening, a good week, and see you next time.